Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Hi there, and welcome to the Explaining History podcast. I'm going to be talking a bit today about West German terrorism during the late 60s and 1970s, really the period from about 67 to 77, when it had its kind of culmination. I'm going to look a little bit about the origins of this phenomena and try to come up with some explanations, which is going to be very difficult because opinions are widely divided over the causes of West German terror. The origins of it really are in the radical student movement of the late 1960s. The individual circumstances in West Germany are quite interesting. Their student movement was galvanised largely against the Vietnam War. There were American air bases, obviously, in West Germany, which was still, to some extent, under conditions of a kind of a light occupation, obviously, as a NATO member and a formerly heavily occupied country. The Americans had a huge military presence in West Germany, partly because of their role to protect against the now formidable Warsaw Pact to the east. So these bases and this presence become a focus of attention for radical student protest. But there's another element to all of this, and to that we have to go deep into the early post-war years of Germany. Now, I did a podcast earlier on this year about the denazification process. It may even have been last year, but if you go back to the list, there's one on denazification and the very limited amount degree to which Germany was thoroughly denazified. There were obviously the regime is destroyed, the regime is banned, the party is banned and can never be a mainstream political force ever again. However, under the Adenauer government, a huge number of Nazis were pardoned. Under the occupying zones of the British, the French and the Americans, it was only the Americans really that pursued denazification with anything like a kind of a real zeal. And they discovered that it was an enormous, gargantuan, almost unmanageable bureaucratic task. The British were more philosophical, or one might say cynical, about this. And they recognised that it was going to be virtually impossible to run the British zone without the help of former Nazis. There was a wide range of individuals, from hardened war criminals all the way down to petty officials who had been in the party either for personal advancement or simply because one's career was untenable without party membership. The purging of all these people would have made the entirety of the British zone unmanageable. And so there were ample opportunities for former Nazis, those who had simply supported the regime and those who perpetrated some of its worst crimes, to slip through into post-Nazi life and to have positions of trust and respectability within Germany for the foreseeable decades. in the East, if you read Tony Judd's post-war, what he points out quite clearly is in the immediate aftermath of the war, all captured Gestapo and SS men were given a simple choice. It was either a one-way train ticket to Siberia or membership of the new East German security apparatus that eventually would become the Stasi. And there were a surprising number of instant converts from Nazism to communism, as soon as it's possible to show that you can thrive and continue ruling in an authoritarian manner. People are more than happy sometimes to embrace this doctrinal change. Now, a really good book to read is Thomas Kohut's A German Generation, and that describes this kind of cloying, imposed amnesia that existed in German families, particularly in West Germany after the war, when the questions about the Holocaust, which wasn't really a fully an open subject until the 60s and 70s, perhaps even the 1980s, when questions such about the Holocaust or the war or what parents had done during the war was arose, it tended to be the standard response in German families to say, please don't bring that up again, let's try to put that in the past and move on. There was also a powerful sense in Germany that if anyone had been a victim of the war, Aryan Germans had. One only needed to look at the degree of devastation brought by British and American bombers and by Russian artillery. The huge numbers lost on battlefields in Russia and North Africa, and the poverty and destruction, particularly brought by the Red Army and the division of Germany, to make a case amongst German people that they had been the victims of this war. What had happened to the Jews? Well, that was unfortunate, but we don't want to dwell on that. And embracing a sense of German victimhood was quite a popular theme. So the questions that the younger generation who were born perhaps during or immediately after the war had tended to go unanswered, and this unsurprisingly led to a degree of frustration, a sense that the older generation weren't being entirely honest. And when we get to the 1960s and we see, as we do in America, there's a kind of generational conflict is taking place, this element of lack of trust becomes a key factor. The prevalent feeling in amongst radical student circles in late 60s, early 70s Germany was that Nazism had never really gone away. Nazism was simply sleeping beneath the surface of a supposedly, a notionally democratic society. But it was a society that was dominated by capitalist interests and the will to go to war. West Germany itself wasn't at war, but it was facilitating America's war in Vietnam. B-52 Stratofortresses were flying from West German bases, and there were various West German hospitals for veterans, for American veterans coming back from Vietnam. So what we see is a fusing of a number of ideas into a particularly convoluted way of looking at the world. Popularity of not sort of Stalinist or Trotskyite Marxism, but now a wave of Maoist Marxism on university campuses, created this notion that now that the war in Vietnam was being supported by the West German government, that the locus of what we could call Nazism or militarist aggression was America, but it was being facilitated by actually real Nazis in Germany who had survived the war, and that instead of pillaging Russia and raising Russia to the ground, now places like Vietnam were being raised to the ground. Now, you might call America's actions imperialist, but it's very difficult to make any connection between the administrations of Kennedy, Lyndon Johnson and Nixon, and anything approaching Nazism, this sort of title of referring to anybody who is right of centre and perhaps has certain reactionary views as being Nazi really tends to do us no good and obviously water down that which is specifically Nazi. So that said, sometimes in order to understand, the actions and the beliefs and the ideas of people at the time, we have to kind of look into the kind of the convoluted ways in which they think. It doesn't necessarily mean we have to give it a kind of a thumbs up, particularly. In 1967, on the state visit of the Shah of Iran to West Germany, a West German protester was killed. Now, the story goes, you'll have to check this one, I'm not sure how apocryphal it is, but it's eminently believable, was that he was actually murdered by two Stasi men dressed as West German policemen in a bid to actually fire up the protesters and to facilitate some kind of revolutionary action. If that was the goal, then this works a treat. My suspicion with what happens later on with the Bader-Meinhof gang and or the Red Army faction, as it's also known, is that when they're executing set-piece kidnaps and assassinations, that I suspect probably they learned how to do that east of the border. Had all sorts of help. Now, into the centre of all this outrage and anger appears Andreas Baader, who himself wasn't a student. He was a nihilistic, fairly poorly read and fairly unpredictable character who enjoyed having a kind of a coterie of radical types around him, and believed that some kind of direct action was justifiable against the state. Whether this stems from any real held political beliefs or the fact that he was an egomaniac who enjoyed these sorts of things is again a matter for debate. His girlfriend, Gudrun Enslin, was the intellectual powerhouse within the Bader-Meinhof gang, or what would later become the Bader-Meinhof gang, and it was she who actually educated him in revolutionary politics. Baader and his little grouping at the time decided to burn down two department stores, basically by in a bid to show that any attack upon the student body was perceived to be an attack by the conglomeration of police and capital as they saw it. And they thought they would strike back at what they saw as kind of as a naked consumerism, which in their view was responsible for atrocities such as the Vietnam War. So Baader was quite...
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Quickly caught and jailed. And 2 years into his jail sentence, Ulrike Meinhof, who had been following the student movement, she was a journalist, a radical intellectual, she helped to spring him from his incarceration. He was allowed a library visit, and he was fairly poorly guarded, and they helped to spring him at that point in a quite an audacious heist. And for the next couple of years, the Bader-Meinhof gang, as it becomes known, or the Red Army faction, as they call themselves, was quite a sort of romantic notion within West Germany. West Germans who were happy to kind of grumble about the government in various ways saw them as a vigilante, romantic sort of notion. This all changes when they start assassinating and blowing people up. The brief Indian summer of popularity for the Bader-Meinhof gang plummets when their real terrorist campaign begins. Bank robberies are one thing, but assassinating policemen and blowing people's legs off is quite another. During this time, they had spent time outside Germany on the run, and they managed to get to Jordan, where they trained with the PLO. Too much, in a way, is made of the connections between different terrorist groups in the 1970s. The kind of Reader's Digest journalism of the time like to imply that the PLO, the IRA, the People's Front for the Liberation of Palestine, the Bader-Meinhof gang, the Weathermen in America, all were kind of connected in some way in some sort of large global conspiracy. No, they weren't. By and large, Palestinian terror organisations had a very different agenda to the Red Army faction and a very different world view. They were certainly not particularly impressed by the Red Army faction, the Bader-Meinhof gang, turning up with women and hoping that they would be trained for urban guerrilla warfare. The Palestinians would later work with West German terror groups during the Munich Olympics, and there an interesting sort of anti-Semitism. I say interesting, an anti-Semitism that comes from very, very surprising and convoluted roots would manifest itself. It manifests itself particularly on the attack on the Israeli team competing in the Olympics. One of the most troubling things for the authorities would have been the emergence of a second generation of the Bader-Meinhof gang. Andreas Bader, Ulrich Meinhof and Gudrun Enslin, Holger Mainz and the originals were caught in 1972, but the bloodshed and violence continued as there were increasingly desperate attempts to try to free them or to raise kind of leverage through kidnappings and hijackings to bargain for their release. They had inspired a certain number of follow-on generations of West German terrorists, largely from the radical student movement, to carry on what they saw as their work. Their work being this rather incoherent war against the West German state, which or a kind of a struggle to finally end what they saw as being Nazism in Germany. The gang went on trial in 1975, and it turned out to be the longest and most expensive trial in German history. Before the trial concluded, Members of the next generation of the Baader-Meinhof gang seized the German embassy in Sweden. After a lengthy siege of about 11 hours or so, two of the gang were killed, and German Chancellor Schmidt made it clear that he wasn't going to negotiate with the Baader-Meinhof gang. During the trial, Ulrich Meinhof was found hanged in her cell. What had happened, most likely she probably killed herself, but obviously in these situations there are all manner of conspiracy theories that she was murdered by the state. In her situation, it looked as if she would never see her children again, and that her entire ideological world had kind of imploded upon itself. She had become basically persona non grata by the rest of the group, and the everything that she had sacrificed for appeared to be lost. So it would make sense that she probably killed herself. That seems most likely. The other three were jailed for life, and that in itself didn't end the crisis. 1977, a year into their sentence, saw the bloodiest year in Germany, and it was dubbed by the media the West German Summer. It saw the kidnap and the assassination of the former SS man Hans-Martin Schleyer. Schleyer had gained the hatred of the left throughout the 1960s during periods of industrial protest with his kind of heavy-handed treatment of striking workers. If there was one figure that really represented everything that the Red Army faction hated, it was Schleyer. He was the president of the Confederation of German Employers Associations and the Federation of German Industries. He's kidnapped on the 5th of September 1977, and it was in some part to try to persuade the government to allow the members of the gang to go free. But it was, I suspect, Schleyer was never going to see the light of day, really. During the same time period, the Red Army faction and Palestinian terrorists had agreed between them to hijack a Lufthansa flight. The flight was flying from Mallorca to Frankfurt, but wound up in Mogadishu, in Somalia, in the end. The pilot was murdered, and the crew, obviously, were under immense threat, as were the passengers. And the demands of the kidnappers were that the founding members of the Red Army faction were freed. The raid was foiled by the German special forces with some help from the SAS, the British SAS. And when this was heard on a smuggled radio into the prison, Baader realised that there was no hope for his situation, and having arranged for his lawyer to smuggle a firearm into the jail, he shot himself, and Gudrun Enslin and Karl Rasp, the final members, both committed suicide as well. Now, when their deaths were revealed, there was a belief amongst the successor generations of the Red Army faction that Schleyer, who had kidnapped Schleyer, that they had been murdered. And so subsequently, they killed Schleyer in revenge. So the summer of 77 became the high point for the gang. After that, it slips really into obscurity, with carrying out sort of sporadic attacks in the 80s and finally into the early 90s. But there is less and less of an incentive in the East to give the gang any help. Now, the lurid details, the attacks, the shootings, the bombings, that sort of thing, whilst all being interesting, it kind of steers away, in effect, from the central question as to why it was in the post-war era, from the late 60s onwards, after this extraordinary economic miracle in Germany that put the country back on its feet, did this kind of phenomenon manifest itself? Why were a small group of young radicals at war with the rest of society? And to me, the answer is the unresolved tensions that denazification, not necessarily created, but failed to address. The failings of denazification, if you like, those strike me as being the fundamental origins of West German terror. Now, let's say that you're writing an essay on Germany, as many of you will be fairly shortly, synoptic kind of essay where you're looking perhaps Germany 1870 to 1989 or beyond. Looking over that long period of time, this is a kind of... story, if you will, this narrative of the Bader-Meinhof gang and West German terror in general, can be related to a broader theme. Perhaps we can look at the broader theme of denazification of Germany in the post-war era. Perhaps we can look at the inability for Germany to confront its past in certain regards. Perhaps it can be used as evidence of something even deeper than that, of Germany's very complex relationship between state and nationalism. After all, what is it that the Bader-Meinhof gang were really objecting to? What was it that the West German radicals were really objecting to? They were objecting to what they had seen as the latent Nazism within German society, which stems from kind of aggressive nationalist militarism, which has its roots far earlier than 1933. You can go all the way back, really, to German unification. And there are obviously instances of anarchist and socialist terror throughout the Kaiserreich and beyond. Anyway, I hope you found that useful. Bit of a ramble this morning. And I'll be updating this podcast later in the week. We're edging closer to our 5,000th listener, so if you're out there, thanks very much. There's a great new newsletter out. We've reviewing some cracking books at the moment, and there's some really exciting developments in the pipeline too. Still trying to work on Explaining History TV on YouTube, but once that's up and running, you guys will be the first to know. Now, if you're looking for a really interesting potted read on the rise and fall of communism, including West German terror, get Chris Kostov's The Communist Century. You can find it at www.explaininghistory.com, and there's a link through there to the Amazon page for it. Check it out today. It's a brilliant read. Thanks very much. Bye-bye.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.